Hello and welcome to another episode of GT Radio. I'm Tino Magnetta, and today I have Michael Olujic, who's a good friend and GM of Palma Casino. Hey, Mike, how you doing, buddy?
Good. How are you doing, Tino?
Doing good. So, we were just talking before. You know, I usually get on with the guests before the show. So, you're Oneida, but you never really grew up on the res, right? You grew up in Iowa, right?
Yeah, I grew up off reservation. My parents grew up in Chicago, which back in the day, a lot of people from the tribes in Wisconsin went down to work, and they met in Chicago. And then my grandfather, my dad's side, had a series of farms in a town in southeast Iowa, and my dad's a tool and die maker, and he just tired of the traffic, so I moved out to a farm in southeast Iowa. And I was born and raised out there, and then good chunk of my family lives in Oneida, and you know, I grew up and see them a lot. But no, I grew up on a cattle farm in southeast Iowa.
Got it. Okay, so were you involved in doing some ranching on the farm and growing up and helping out and everything?
Yeah, we had a beef cattle farm. We started off with like 5 cattle, and when my dad sold it all when I graduated high school, went to college, we had about 100 head. And then we had beef cattle, so we go through calving season. I was like a 4-H, used to show cows and stuff like that, and bale hay, build fence. So yeah, I had that upbringing. It was a good upbringing. I don't regret it at all. Built a lot of character. So
yeah, I can imagine. That's really interesting. Is really interesting upbringing. That's for sure. So who's Oneida on your both your mother and father, or just your mother? Or
My mother's Oneida. My dad's Croatian.
Your mother's Oneida. Okay.
And my dad's Croatian. He's a first generation U.S. citizen, and my grandma and grandpa on my dad's side immigrated over from Croatia.
Got it.
The 1950s or 40s.
So how big is the Oneida tribe?
It's around 20,000 members. Of which half of them reside in Green Bay, and then about 25% of them in Wisconsin, and another 25% all over the country, which I was one of the other 25% when I was a kid. So, yeah.
So what was it? Of course, you have friends that grew up on the res, right?
Oh, yeah. Most of my family grew up on the Oneida Reservation.
Yeah.
So I went up there multiple times a year.
Yeah. So what was it like? Because I want to get people, this is important to understand, you know, how much gaming did for the tribes. What was it like before the bingo, before the first casino was built? What was it like on the res?
I mean, Oneida was always a real nice reservation. I mean, the area, if, you know, anybody goes up to Green Bay and goes visit the Oneida Reservation, it's very picturesque and beautiful. There's a lot of farming, we had a series of sea stores, not with casinos. But, you know, of course, there wasn't a lot of money around. So, you know, you still had a lot of outhouses, you know, a lot of mud floor houses. And, you know, until the casino started coming up. Oneida invested a lot, though, in their infrastructure, the government infrastructure, education, tribal programs to help their membership. So, you know, once the money started coming in, we built, you know, a new health center, you know, nicer housing for elders, housing for, you know, all the community members. And Oneida, you get, if you maintain a 2.5 GPA or better, they pay for your college, you know, room and board, up to $20,000
a
semester. So that's a really big benefit. And then there's just a lot of job opportunities that they have for their members. They do a lot of employment. I think Oneida, I don't know, when I was there to see it, when I was a CFO, they were employed like 3,000. I think it's dwindled down. I think it's made like 2,400, but over 50% of the 50% of employees are tribal member at the United Nations. So we employ a lot of our tribal members in gaming or governmental services.
That's great. So the it started off as the bingo, right, first?
Yep. It started off as the bingo. It was, Island Moore Activity Center. And then it kind of grew into gaming within the bingo hall. Now, you know, Oneida has, you know, 3 large casinos, and I believe, I think it's like 6 or 7. They've consolidated a couple of them. From what I remember, 6 or 7 C store with casinos in them, with slot machines. gas station and convenience store type of combo. So, you know, that's kind of what they've expanded to now. You know, in the grander Green Bay area.
Sure. Mike, what was your first experience in gaming? Where did you start?
I started my first experience in gaming. I was at IBM right out of college, and I worked there for about 5 years. And then my own tribe recruited me. I was in a role to be assistant chief financial officer, but I was actually acting as a chief financial officer. We had a longstanding chief financial officer for our tribe, and he took a position somewhere else, and they did a database search, and I was one of the few people that qualified at that point in time. And I got a call, and 2 weeks later, I was an acting chief financial officer of my tribe, and that's what first got me into part of gaming is on the accounting, benefits, purchasing, HR side of the casino, which matrixed underneath me as a tribal CFO. So that was my first experience, and I spent about 2 years doing that.
So you went to school for to become a CPA and a CFO in the finance area, right?
Yeah, I went to school in Iowa State as an accountant, and I was going to be a CPA or and within accounting, but then went to IBM and they used me as a strategic analyst, and then came to Oneida as a CFO, but then directions kind of changed after a couple of years because then I got full-fledged as a general manager 2 years later at North Star Mohegan Casino Resort in Bowler, Wisconsin.
Okay, so you were there for 2 years, and then you went over to Mohegan, and that's when I met you at Mohegan.
Yeah, I was at Mohegan for about four or five years. I was there, and I built their – I was the CEO, and then I acted as owner's rep, and I built their Mohegan Casino Resort that they have now, North Star. So.
Yeah, I've been up there. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful casino.
Beautiful.
I really love that casino.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to hold the master plan, and that's kind of cool because after I left, the master plan was further executed. So that was kind of nice to see how we master planned it, and I was deeply involved in master planning that for phases. And it's kind of rewarding seeing that master plan kind of come out after you leave too, and it's executed very similar to what you designed when you, when I was in the job. So that's always satisfying. North Star always has a place in my heart there because I built that and they gave me my first shot. So I always have a lot of gratitude towards the stock, the Fletcher Tribe, and then North Star. So.
Yeah, and who was the vice chair at the time? Remember the guy that I can't remember
Greg
his name
Miller.
Now.
Greg Miller, the guy with the
Beatles
and the hunting. Greg Miller.
Yeah, what was his name? Greg Miller, great guy.
Yeah, Greg Miller. Yeah. Yeah.
Great guy.
He
took me
guy.
To his. He took me to a tour of the res and showed me all the things that they were doing and then took me to his place where he made a venison sandwich for me, which was one of the best sandwiches I've ever eaten.
Yeah, he's a good cook, and he has all his beagles and stuff. He's a big hunter. So,
yeah. I remember that was a really great experience coming up there. It's really cool. It reminds me so much of Canada with the forest and everything.
Oh yeah. It's very interesting how it changed the topography and the climate and the range changes when you go to Green Bay to when you go to, Bowler, Wisconsin, which is only about less than an hour away, but it's totally a different type of, environment when you get up there, So it was really
completely
working there.
It's completely.
Yeah.
Completely
yeah.
different time. So, yeah. What were some of the, when you first started in gaming, what were some of the hurdles that you had to overcome, going to college and all of a sudden being thrust into, full-scale casino? What were some of the hurdles?
The biggest challenge I had is I got into it in 2007, and that's when casinos first had, started their recession-proof. So that was a big challenge, but I think it was an advantage, me coming from my analyst and finance background, because I really kind of with that, I was big into database and big into, looking at the reinvestment and, starting to understand the slot machines. And, for me, I gained a pretty quick grasp because a lot of it's math, and I'm a very analytical and math-based person. And really, gaming and the outcome of gaming with slot machines, table games, it's all math-based, and also marketing and the database. Now you got the brand aspect, you got to implement, and that stuff I had to learn over time. you know, into guest experience type of things and some of that. But I really kind of was at advantage because I was able to, you know, really grasp onto the math and the analytics side, you know, of that. And that's what gaming basically is. And I kind of looked at that approach at that time when a lot of operators were not as analytical because they didn't have to be, because every year there's continuously growing, growing, and growing. And then when that recession hit in 2006, 2007, that's when you start seeing casinos being shut down, you know, or being de-scoped, or, you know, they're finally starting to see shrinkage in their market. So, you know, that's one thing that helped me kind of grasp into the industry. Was that I think the time was kind of fortunate for me because it became more database-based and more reinvestment-based and more return on investment views, you know, on gaming. So that was the biggest challenge, but it also was, I think, the right time for me to came in. I was very thankful I came in during that time.
Yeah, because before that, a lot of that stuff they weren't paying attention to because money was coming in boatloads.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was. I always said it all fucking crap in the middle of the gaming floor and people would step over and they're still making money, you know. And that changed.
Yeah.
Once 2006, 2007 happened, you know. So.
And I think for the better, it makes the market, it makes the operations more serious, more, you know, it plays more into what you do, the finance.
Yeah,
and
it made
a
lot more efficient.
Thing.
Yeah, you had to become more efficient. You had to become like some of the industries out there that have become very mature and come from an IT side and IT outsourcing. And, you know, like, you know, I was accustomed to that. So right sizing the business and making it so you can drive efficient, you know, efficient flow through from your revenue to your bottom line. You know, that became more strategic and that became, you know, kind of a more of a focal point.
Yeah. Tell us a little. There's quite a few trends out there in gaming. You know, do you see any that could change the business, like online gaming, or, you know, in those trends that we, you know, as casino operators, we need to be aware of because that could change the whole paradigm of what we do.
Yeah, I mean, I see some trends with online gaming, and you know, sometimes it gains some traction. It seems like it takes 3 step forward and 2 step back, but eventually it is going to happen. It's really just being cognizant of when to kind of dive in fully and really kind of understand what the reinvestment and the revenue sharing model is with, you know, with some of the prime vendors that are providing that solution. And I think the major thing also is protecting your database to make sure that your player data, you know, is safe and secure and that you have ownership of that. But with that, I think there's an evolution. The biggest challenge I really believe is really figuring out what do people want that are now in their 40s and in early 50s and maybe late 30s, figure out what's going to stimulate them when they have a discretionary income and they, you know, they get into their 60s and 70s. I think people always like to come to casinos, especially elderly people, because, you know, it's a safe environment. You have EMT staff there. It's not physical, so it provides a social aspect for people in that age. But it's really kind of understanding what they're going to like at that point in time and how gaming is going to have to evolve at the property level to keep them engaged. I think that that's the biggest challenge, I think, that will be coming forward, because I think, you know, brick-and-mortar casinos will always be here. The amount of revenue they get might be shared a little bit more with some online aspects, but what's going to really engage the people that are in their late 30s or early 50s now, 10, 15 years now, when they're, you know, the prime demographic that's going to be at the casino.
Right. So you're saying that what you're doing right now is you're trying to get those younger players to like it so that they keep going even more as they get older, correct? Because you see the trend,
yeah,
where the older people have more discretionary fund. Is that right?
Yeah, and I think it's just the bell curve of as people become older, they have more discretionary spending. And it's just really understanding what those younger people are going to like and what's going to stimulate them, that when they get approached that age, when they're going to have that discretionary and the casino's going to be more of an appealing place for them to go and socialize, how that's going to work, you know, and how you're going to be able to engage them. And also what the cross-platform you're going to have between your online and social gaming, and how does that tie into your brick-and-mortar gaming to make sure that you have that you can leverage that, you know. So that's a big challenge, and also it's just you have so much competition out. Everybody's your competitor these days, and you know, with social media and how that's growing, you know, just gotta be cognizant of that and figure out how your casino, how your any business, I think, not just casinos but any business, needs to figure out how they fit into that fold of how the social media is drastically expanding.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you want to be stuck
in general,
retail. Look at retail.
Yeah, completely put on its head, right?
Yep. So it's really looking at your pricing model, looking at how you engage them, looking at that type of genuine value they get so you don't end up like brick-and-mortar malls that you see and shut down now. It's kind of sad, you know?
Yeah, they're all disappearing. Because, like
you
said, you need something to stimulate them, right? You can't just do the same old thing over and over.
No.
You got to reinvent yourself.
Yeah, and you got to look at community gaming, you know, that type of stuff. So I think the younger generation is more into that social aspect of them all participating. So you got to look at some community type of gaming aspects, whether you kind of put them in restaurants, like in your booths, and engage them that way, or just ways that you can get more of that community and that community type of social gaming aspect so you can keep them engaged. So I have a feeling that's what as they get older, they're going to want to see that community type of gaming platform.
Yeah.
Well,
Mike, what's the most important element of running a casino?
The most important element of running a casino, I think it's really your team members. Make sure your frontline staff's empowered. You know, you can set the strategic direction, do everything, build a beautiful property, have the right games out there. But if your frontline team is not empowered to do their jobs and don't take that ownership and that pride in doing their jobs, you know, you'll fall short on the execution and delivery, and you'll see your revenue decline. So all the properties I go into, I really look at their policies and procedures, streamline them, get employee input, make sure that the employees have all the tools they need to be successful, and then really kind of work with them to make their jobs as easy as possible, because I want them to do a solely focus on the guest engagement and how it can improve the guest experience. And, you know, you got some PMPs you got to follow based off core regulations, but everything that's not regulatory required, you know, I strip out and just really keep them focused on, you know, the core competency of their job and how they're engaging and how they're enhancing the guest experience. When you do that, you really see an empowered workforce, and at the end of the day, that kind of has a waterfall effect into really, you know, good guest service and happy customers.
Yeah, it's important to the customer service level really has to be high, especially within an environment of enhanced competition, right?
Yeah, oh yeah, and we have a lot of competition out in Southern California, especially in the stretch of Palma Valley, so. You know, we get a lot of cross-play between all the properties, so you got to make sure that you deliver on your guest service and that you provide a genuine value to the guests, because they're literally 3 minutes away from three or four other casinos. So you need to be cognizant of that, and you need to make sure that the employees are happy, are compensated properly, their benefits are strong so they feel that you care for them, and that, you know, they're able to come to work and focus on their jobs and enjoy their jobs. You know, that is key to make it sure you fend off the competition. You try to create continuous growth.
So you where you are now, you have more competition than where, the other casinos that you were at?
Yeah, I mean, at Gila River, you know, when you're in Phoenix, Phoenix is just a mass populated area, and with the restriction of games, you know, and also the prime age there, you know, big retirement area, is, you know, competition was not as I think as fierce as it is in Southern California. We do have, you know, a good degree of population, but, you know, the location where I'm at, you know, I'm boxed in by two casinos to the east and two casinos to the west of me before the guests get to my place. So I need to make sure that, you know, we're able to kind of have that guest service execution. You need to make sure the gaming product is fresh and competitive. And you need to make sure the food and beverage product drives the overall value to the guests to get them to become loyal to Casino Palma. So,
right. I see. Tell us a little bit about the tribe. How many members does it have, and a little bit of, you know, what it's like, what the people are like, and, you know.
Yeah, the tribe. I got a range. I think it's between about 220 and 260 members. I don't have the exact count. The reservation just above the casino. The tribal memberships are very good people. They're hardworking, and they treat the casino very well, and they treat their staff pretty good. I really enjoy being there. We're kind of looking at around the finishing touches of breaking ground of a new property. But it's a very good tribe, very good community. I enjoy being there.
Yeah, that's great. So what you're breaking ground on more casino space and hotel?
We're looking to potentially build a new replacement casino. That casino is one of the sprung structures, multiple expansions. So the facility is beyond its depreciable life. And, in order for us to continue gaming operations, with all the infrastructure you'd have to put in there, it's just wearing old. So we're in the process of developing a replacement casino to really sustain the revenue base that we've achieved. And hopefully enhance, with the goal of enhancing the revenue base a little bit as well and growing our market a little bit more. But with that, just casino is very worn, and it's totally time for a new one. So, yeah, we're looking forward to
that. Yeah, that's cool. That's exciting.
Yeah, hopefully in the winter we'll be breaking ground sometime soon. So
that's great. Congratulations. You were talking about all the competition in there, and I always get asked that. Where's the market heading in California with all the expansion and building? Can it handle the growth? Is it? I know everybody's building something or expanding.
Yeah.
So talk a little bit towards that.
I think it can handle the growth. The interesting thing about this market, because I've been, in Wisconsin, Michigan. And Arizona before coming here to California. People in the California market will travel a couple hours to get to a resort. For them, doing that type of travel time is not a hindrance to them. So, I think with, the L.A., Orange County, the San Diego market, and all the local communities that are between that, I believe all the casinos, there's enough capacity there. And I believe, a lot of these casinos, like you see across the country, a lot of them were probably time for a refresh because, a lot of the properties have probably been 8 to 10 plus years without any significant improvements or some minor models. So
right.
I just think, right now the market's strong. You can get the finance, the ability to get capital is cheap now. So I believe a lot of tribes are going all in and making sure to capture that reinvestment to enhance their properties and to refresh them because it's just, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You got people coming out of your building. Eventually, you're going to have to refresh it. I believe the Southern California market, especially, is actually in that mode right now because a lot of properties are just in need to be updated and to be, either replaced just due to the utilization of them, over the past 10 years.
Yeah. It's kind of like a cycle, right?
Yeah.
And now they got to renovate them. Yeah.
The cycles all come at the same time, so all of them are kind of – there's a lot of construction going on in Southern California now, and that's just due to the timing, I believe, of cheap capital, and it's just the tribes are prime and planning, and wanting to do it, but now is the time just due to the ability of getting, cheap capital funding right now.
Yeah. So give us a little sense of what do you see in the future – for Native Nations, what are you seeing now, and how do you think moving forward 10-20 years, should the tribes be diversifying? Should they be focused on online gaming? Should they get into verticals like hotel? Where's the growth? Where's the expansion?
I think tribes will still have to invest and keep up to date their gaming facilities. You always have the online gaming aspect of it. But I think tribes also need to look at utilizing that capital. And my approach is more being a silent investor into expanding companies in their local markets or national markets that really kind of leverage them as a as an investment type hub so they can generate diversified income. Sometimes with tribes, unless you have really streamlined processes, it's hard for tribes at times due to just approval processes that are required to take place just due to our historical things that have happened in the past. Having an economic development arm with, you know, a separate LLC or decision we make quickly, or, you know, being silent investors in startup companies or in companies looking to expand, and really utilizing that capital that we have from our gaming resources to really create that investment and that business development hub, and really kind of be a place to for companies to come to and get capital for their growth and expansion, and really then reaping the reinvestment and benefits of that. Then we can fold that back in the communities. I think that's one of the things that, you know, tribes are really have to start looking into, is that not trying to manage a brick and mortar as a business, but being that silent partner for multiple businesses in their, you know, within their respective areas, within their respective locations, that they can really be that greenfield funding for companies to grow and prosper, and maybe tribes gain that, reap that benefit from that.
Yeah, and it seems like more and more of the tribes have people who are tribal members that can help them make those decisions. Whereas, you know, 20 years ago, that was difficult, right?
Yeah, it's very difficult. I think, you know, what tribes need to really look at is that at times we want, as tribes, we want to run our own businesses. But, you know, with the capital that we have available, sometimes allowing other people to grow their existing businesses and just reap the financial reward and get the investment on an investment perspective is a lot more beneficial than at times trying to do brick and mortar business development.
Yeah, exactly. What advice would you give, you know, anybody that's starting out in the business? What would you tell them?
I think just be a chameleon and listen, and really learn. Each casino is uniquely different. In Indian country, each tribe is uniquely different. While there's a lot of similarities, you just really got to get a lay of the land and understand how each tribe uniquely operates and adjust to that. I think you got to be open-minded, because each casino is uniquely different. You can have one across the street from the other, and it's a totally different operation. So I'd say never assume anything and go into every property fresh out of eyes, and be open that you know, things are uniquely different each property, and you got to adjust to that to make it successful. So that's what I'd really recommend, is get in there, do your hard work, understand the market, understand the tribe, what you're working for, and once you get a grasp of all of that, then make the right decisions to find ways to either grow revenue or create efficiencies in the business to drive a higher royalty transfer over to the community.
That's great. Great stuff, Mike. Let's take some questions and see what we got here. Hello, welcome to GT Radio. Do you have a question for Michael Lujic? Hello, this is GT Radio. Can you hear us? Hello? Oh, we can try back on that one. Hang on one sec. Hello, this is GT Radio. You have a question for Michael? Hello? Hello? That's weird. Hang on one sec. Let's see here. Michael, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Just want to make sure you're on. Hang on one sec. I don't know why that's on. Hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Michael?
Hi, Kano. It's Rich. How are you?
Hey, good.
Good. Michael, just my question for you is, you seem to be like a very analytical decision maker. How much of your decisions are totally analytical, and how much are gut feelings, like gut instinct as to, you know, the right decision on a marketing program or, you know, expansion? Like, do you let gut feeling play any factor in your decisions?
Oh, of course. I think when I first got in the industry, it was probably 75% analytical and 25% gut feeling. I think now it's probably, I would say, maybe about 50-50. And with analytics, too, it's just, you know, I keep my really analysis really simplistic, because I know you can kill yourself with paralysis by analysis. And, you know, I look at high-level type of things to make sure we get the data's right, make sure it ties with financials. Then I drill down, you know, more in-depth, you know, with reinvestments and looking at if you're going to build or not, whether you're going to remodel a venue or not, what type of promotion would you do and how it works. But
But now I kind of get the core data for something. I'm going to make a decision, and I say it's about 50-50. I still, you got to go with your gut, too, because, data's great, but at the end of the day, it's the decision behind the data that really creates the reinvestment and creates the success or the failure. So I'd say 50-50.
Okay.
So you're saying it's a combination, right, Mike?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a combination of gut feeling. And now I have more experience understanding what I've seen in the past and, just kind of having – still got to go with the gut as well. Data is good, but, when you're building a new venue, building a new property, doing a promotion, if you wait for all the data to be perfect, your competition is already past you, and it's too late. So you're going to have to take some risk. And with that risk, that's when discretion comes into play, because – we don't use discretion. We might as well not even be GMs or directors. That's my view.
Rich, did you have another question for Michael?
Just more of a personal one. Any hobbies that outside the workplace here?
Oh, any hobbies? Just get like snow skiing, working out. Like to go eat, have some cocktails every once in a while. Like to go see wineries and stuff like that. So that's about it.
All right.
That's good. Yeah, well, our business is it lends itself towards that, right?
Yeah.
All right, thanks, Rich. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
You got to go see all the food and beverage venues. You got to really go out there, because if not, you don't catch the cutting-edge things a lot of these smaller restaurants do that you can really implement into your properties.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. That experience you can use and implement with what you're doing, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I constantly go out to, restaurants, new venues, look at how they're designed, look at kind of what they might have on their menu, look at what they're doing for service, look what they're doing for uniforms, just to get an idea of what you might be able to kind of take from that and use to enhance your property.
Yeah, that's good advice. Good stuff. Well, it's a good work to have to do, that's for sure. All right, thanks, Rich.
Thanks.
All right, let's go to another question here. Hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Michael? Hello? Okay. Hello, this is GT
Hello?
Radio. Do you have a question for Michael? Hello?
Hello, Mike? Yep. Hello?
Yeah, he's here.
Oh, good, good. Sorry. Hey, Mike, you mentioned that your dad was originally from Croatia?
Yeah.
Now, what have you noticed, throughout the years, especially as a young person, just the mixing of the cultures? Or did you have, as a Croatian family, in the States, or have you ever, been out there yourself?
I've actually never been to Croatia, unfortunately. I'm going to go out there one of these days. I need to. But I had a unique upbringing because, I had one half of my family is, Native American and traditional and with the Native American traditions. And then the other half of my family is old school Croatian European, where they have my grandfather owned a machine shop and my grandmother owned a beauty salon, and they kind of were on Sundays all their friends and family come out and they cook all that European food and have their wine and their shlivovitz and their beer and just kind of sit there and have that social aspect. So for
right.
me, I kind of got, diverse background by those different cultures. And I really enjoyed that. It was, I was very blessed as a child to have both of those diverse type of, really a polar opposite type of backgrounds where I came from, So.
Yeah, a mixture of, quite a mixture.
Yeah.
Wait, can I ask another question?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
Yeah, but Mike, tell us, how do you handle all the competition that's around you?
What we really got to do is just kind of keep an eye on what they're doing, but focus really on with all the competition that's around me, I really focus on the execution of the property which I manage. I really focus to make sure that the players are getting the right value, whether through marketing, reinvestment, promotions, genuine value in my food and beverage. And really the good guest experience, but you also got to keep an eye on the competition, see what type of direct mail offers they're doing, what their marketing programs are, what they're doing in food and beverage to make sure you don't get caught.
and respond to that rather quickly. If you find that something's going on, or you see a fluctuation in your market or fluctuation in your database, to be able to move on a dime with either eBlast or some sort of supplemental mailer to make sure you maintain that guest base. So I have to really look at detail on, multiple times a week or almost a daily basis to see if there's any trends with my guest set. And if I start seeing any type of declining trends, we have to make a rather quick type of adjustment to make sure that we keep our customers engaged, because the competition's so close and the players can go from private property so easy. So you got to be really on top of what's going on and seeing what type of trending data and making the proper adjustment.
Right, yeah. It's like you're moving on the dime. Well,
yeah. You're almost doing analysis in real time, right? Because you got four casinos to deal with. So you have to manipulate things constantly.
Yeah, we're doing real-time analysis, and with that real-time analysis, the data, you can only get such good data, so that's where you got to use that discretion. You got to roll the dice sometimes and say, well, if I sit and wait too long, then the month end might be shot, my year-over-year number might show degradation in my revenue instead of the growth, which I'm looking for, which I need to do when you're looking at building a replacement casino as well.
Right, right. Yeah, that's important. Okay, great. Did you have any other questions for us?
Well, just quickly, I mean, Mike, if somebody really wanted to learn, the most they could in the casino business, and they're, trying to get an entry-level position, is there one kind of position or area that you would recommend among any others to really get a fast learn of the biz?
I would say like revenue audit or some sort of accounting function, just because you see the cash flows, you understand the financial statements, you see all the financial transactions that go into play, and from that you can really kind of go out into the different competencies and really understand that even more. But I would say somewhere in the accounting, revenue audit area would be the best place to start out. I'm so thankful I came from a finance and accounting background, going to IBM from that, but with understanding the financials and gaining a grasp of the financials quickly, you're able to back into the business operation. So that's what I'd recommend.
Right, great. Thanks. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in. Okay. Let's try one of these ones that couldn't hear us. See if they can hear us now. Hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Michael? Hello? GT Radio. Oh, okay. Try this again here. Sometimes the studio here is a little funky, so let's see if this person's around. Hello, this is GT Radio. You have a question for Michael. Hello? Hello, hello? I guess not. Okay, let's try this. Hello, this is GT Radio. Do you have a question for Michael?
Yeah. First of all, I just want to, Mike, this is Golly. I just want to commend you on your career, especially at such a young age. You're definitely a role model for, the next generation. But my question is, why don't you think more natives have taken advantage of the opportunities that you've taken, whether it's education or progressing your career by actually leaving your tribe? And what can be done to have more people or more natives follow your lead?
I mean, I think for me, it was because I grew up off reservation. I came on reservation quite a bit. I believe it's a challenge, just for a lot of natives, because they're so ingrained with their family. Family is so important. So once they go to college, what I really recommend people do is really go to college, and before you go back and work for your tribe, and this was told to me by the CFO of my tribe before I left when I got out of college, go out and work for, a Fortune 50 company. That's experience that you that's worth gold, because you really understand how the business operates, understand the kind of quarterly numbers, the goals. It teaches that structure. They have training programs that teach if you're excelling, in an area in the field you're in, they have management training programs that teach you how to be executives and you get to work with some of the smartest people. I mean, I was very fortunate at IBM. I worked with a lot of very intelligent senior vice presidents, general managers, and with that, I was able to listen, learn, and kind of get understand their thought process. And then at that point in time, when I felt I had enough tools, and actually I didn't think I'd leave IBM that quickly, but you know, I got a phone call in 2 weeks as CFO of my own tribe, which doesn't happen at all, hardly. But with that, I really had that good business base. So, you know, what I'd recommend is the easiest thing for you know, members, and we really got to push people in the country, is that when they get out of college, the tribe really developed programs that really push them to go out and get that experience. Because if they try to, if the tribes, because they're so tied to family, that way you're younger, you may not be married or may not have any kids yet. So, you know, that 5 years of going out and getting that corporate experience is really kind of priceless, and then coming back to your tribe. So I think tribes really need to make a strong effort about education and then about going out in the business world and getting that experience. And really what we need to do in Indian country too is that, you know, we need to look at providing, make sure compensation is competitive, and, you know, make sure people in certain fields have pay that will want them to come back to their tribe and that they'll be able to stay with their tribe with that. So, you know, I think it's really the tribes really need to really focus on pushing their students to, instead of come back and work for a tribe rather than graduate college, to really go out and experience those Fortune 50 companies, which give you that, you know, kind of that priceless type of experience that you can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, that's really good advice.
Okay, great.
Did you have another question?
Yeah. So on your, you know, personally, what is the next step for Michael Lujic? Where do you go from here, you know, the next 5-10 years, with the career path that you're progressing on? Has been, you know, pretty, you know, great already, but what's the next step?
I don't know. You know, for me, I think it's, and I'm pretty happy where I'm at now. I'm getting treated really well. It's really kind of hard, you know, leaving Southern California because, you know, even in summer, it's in the morning and in the evening, it's cool. And, you know, in the summer here in Temecula, California, it might get 100 degrees, 105 degrees. But, at, you know, 7 o'clock at night, it's 70 degrees. And, you know, 5 in the morning, 6 in the morning, it's like 50, 60 degrees. I think me just, with me, it's, you know, this will be, you know, kind of a second major build that I've for ground up. You know, I'd like to see that through fruition. And for me, it's just really kind of finding, you know, whether I stay here or whether I move somewhere else in the future. It's really trying to finding that tribe or finding that project or that property where, you know, I kind of feel I can drive genuine value and get the best reinvestment for the membership. So for me, it's just really kind of finding some place where I have more stability or that is going to be more of the long term. Because, you know, from when I was 21 till now, I've moved about 15 times. So at that point in time, it's kind of really finding what makes me happy based off, you know, the tribe I work for, the casino that I run and build, and then the overall area that I live in. So right now I'm pretty happy where I'm at, and I think I got a good 5 to 7 years that's going to keep me very busy. But, you know, the next step will probably find something, whether I stay here or go somewhere else. It's just finding that that balance, I guess.
Okay, I got one last question.
Yeah.
I'm assuming you're a Packers fan?
Well, of course, yeah.
So I asked the same question to Chairman Stevens. If you had to pick one, and you can only pick one, who do you got, Favre or Rodgers?
Rodgers. He makes better decisions.
Hey, at least you made a decision. Chairman Stevens couldn't make a decision.
Yeah, the other guys didn't want to commit.
I'll take Rodgers. He's the best player in the league right now. I take Rodgers hands down every time.
Yeah,
great.
I agree.
All right, thanks, guys. Appreciate it. All right, let's move on. Mike, you hit on something that I think is so important, and I want to expand on this a little bit. You attribute a lot of your kind of like if you look at your trajectory, you grew up off the res, then you were. Had some good advice to actually go to school, do everything that you had to do, and take a job at a big company to see how that was. How do we get more native new generation to think that way? Because for you, it's been very successful. And I know for people like Joe and Noya Kuwanabi, it's been successful. And there's been a lot of people out there who have taken this trajectory. And we always see success in this strategy. But we also see a lot of fear among the other generations, getting out of that box, so to speak. Talk a little bit about what they need to do.
I think they just need to come to terms that it's okay to be uncomfortable. Because you don't, when you learn the most is when you're uncomfortable. And I learned that young in age. And if you don't challenge yourself and get uncomfortable, you're not going to really know what your true potential is. Or you might not even reach your potential. So it's really, I think, because in Indian country, a lot of children are so comfortable and so protected because a lot of the, on your reservation with all your family. And now it's times there have been, a lot of times they're very successful. There's a lot of programs in place and a lot of jobs in place that it's very easy. It is very easy for a tribal member just to go and work within the reservation because it's safe. And, it's good pay, good benefits, and they're around their family. But I think it's just really the tribes need to make a really hard effort. And do the companies want Native Americans working for them? I mean, companies want, when they go to job fairs or go to college, they're actively seeking educated Native Americans to come into their companies because it brings that diversity into that company culture as well. And I think it's really embracing that challenge, embracing being uncomfortable, and really embracing kind of that partnership. And maybe tribes need to really reach out to, to make tribal members feel more comfortable. Maybe they need to really reach out and develop some partnerships with some Fortune 50 companies that are in their respective areas, So, the youth can go out to those companies and really get that development. So, in the future, tribes might have to really kind of develop some strategic partnerships and some management training programs with some of the Fortune 50 companies, in their given backyard. So, it's a little more comfortable for tribal members that kind of grew up within their communities that they can go out and get that experience and still kind of have that, have the best of both worlds or feel the comfort of the family, feel comfortable with their community, but also be able, if in their community, go into that challenge of working for those Fortune 50 companies and getting that that experience that is that I think is really priceless.
Yeah, that's good. So, for you, was that experience was when you went to work at IBM?
Yeah, for me, because I worked at John Deere as an intern before that, but I worked at IBM. I always tell people, go work for one of the top companies if you have the opportunity because they teach you so much. You mean work hard. I worked 80, 90 hours a week. I worked like a dog. I travel all over the country. But you know what? It's priceless to be able to sit with, a senior VP that has been in the trenches and actually be in those meetings or be on those conference calls and kind of look at what type of data they need, what type of information they need, what type of discretionary decision-making that they make in order to make their given area successful. And you can't put a price on that. And people with that type of experience and be able to just be there and work hard and be a sponge, really is priceless. And that's kind of what I always tell everybody that I meet is go do that and work hard, keep your nose to the grindstone, put in a bunch of hours, travel, do what they ask you to do, because then you'll get at seat at the table or you get a seat at the conference calls. And then you really get to listen to how they make decisions, why they make decisions, what type of information they need to make the right decisions. And that was experience that I still apply today. And, I'll always apply it for the rest of my career. And I worked really hard at IBM. They worked like, I'm forever grateful for that experience.
What was it like the first week you were there emotionally? I mean, that's a big company to get into after, growing up on the farm and, I mean, what was that like?
Oh, it was interesting. I go to a big city, it was really fun. For me, I thought it was just, I just really embraced it. The tough thing about it is with IBM, they'd hire like 300 people, and then they'd all put them in the different regions. And, they didn't care what school you're from. So I had people from Ivy League schools, people with MBAs. I mean, I got my MBA later in my career. And I was from Iowa State. But they bring you all in and you do the same job. And, what happened to me is that, you have some people talk about theory of the business, you know, trying to talk about things when they're just an entry-level financial analyst, where I kind of took the approach of really working with the people that I supported, you know, in the divisions I supported, working hard, keep my mouth shut, you know, and going out and really partnering with the divisions I supported. And then September 11th happened, you know, in 2001. That's when I came out, you know, graduated college, and all those guys talking to me in business and trying to be an advisor to these directors that have been operating the business for, you know, 10 years, 20 years that know it, and trying to be that advisor instead of just getting the work done and giving the data they need to make decisions. About 70% of them got canned, and thank God I stayed in there. But, you know, I'll be realistic too. Affirmative action probably played in a little bit too. You know, you can't, you know, the one Native American kid that was out of the whole 300, I thought they would, unless I was doing something drastically wrong, they probably were going to keep me. But, you know, I think, you know, keep my nose to the grindstone. I think a lot of work ethic I had, so growing up on a cattle farm, is doing your job, doing it right, making sure you put in the hours, you know, to make sure it's done right and listen to people, that really kind of paid off. So.
You were the only Native American out of the 300 people, right?
Yeah, I think I was. There might have been another one, but I think I was, yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. What an accomplishment.
Well, the thing
is, in finance,
that's when Defoe is becoming such a bigger player, and then Defoe needs to be a bigger player, is that not too many Native Americans go into the financial area. You know, a lot go into legal. You know, a lot of Native Americans go into the legal trade, you know, and that type of stuff, but not that many, and still today you don't see a ton of Native Americans go into financial accounting, you know.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I just think maybe it's because the math aspect doesn't intrigue some people, but, you know, I think Defoe has done a great job trying to do outreach and trying to educate people on the importance of finance and accounting, and, you know, you're starting to see it grow more, but Tino, when I came out of college, you'd have 10 Native lawyers to maybe every, or 20 Native lawyers to one Native American that had an accounting degree, you know. So,
wow.
You know, and in other fields, social services and different things, but accountants are really, I think you're seeing more of them, and I try to encourage Native Americans to go into accounting and go into finance just because that's one of the areas where there's a big shortage. You know, you have Natives going into the medical field, legal field, you know, social services, that type of stuff. It's growing, but it's still, you know, with some of the math aspect of it or the finance accounting, there's still a gap there.
Wow. That's pretty incredible. That's even more of an accomplishment getting into somewhere where it's not really, your brother's also an accountant, right? Joe, right?
Yeah. He came through the accounting ranks as well. So, yeah.
Yep. Wow, yeah, amazing. Yep. The duo. That's great. So give us some your parting words for the next generation coming in. What wisdom can you give them to remember?
What wisdom can I get? I don't know if I have much wisdom.
What is the most important thing?
I would say most important thing is put in the work. Put in the time. You have to put in the time. I think a lot of people today, I have a lot of young individuals come to me and say, oh, well, I want to be you. Well, in order to get there, you got to put in the work. And you got to surround yourself with smart people, listen to them, learn from them, work hard. And if you grind it out, work hard, you know, stay focused on getting education. You know, after, you know, if you do 5 hard years or 10 hard years where you put in some service hours, like 80 hours a week, you know, that you'll reap the benefits from that. If you don't work hard and you do 30 hours or 40 hours and, you know, you say you want the role, but you're not doing the work for the role, it may take you longer. You might be put in a position where you might get the job, but you're struggled and you're not prepared for it. So I would say put in the work, put in the time. And you reap the benefits of that, you know, later in your career. And, you know, I was very fortunate to be in positions where I had to work hard and had to work a lot up front in my career. Now today, you know, I work and I put in hours I need to when I need to, but it gives me the luxury of now I have more experience and knowledge. And, you know, I have the staff where, you know, I can enjoy life a little bit more and have that work-life balance. But in the beginning, grind it out because it'll pay dividends in the future.
That's great. Mike, thanks so much for your time. It's been a great interview, and let's get you back on the show sometime after you guys have finished the expansion. Really want to hear everything about it.
Sounds good, Tino. Thank you very much.
Thank you, buddy. Take care. Well, that was great. Mike is definitely a role model for anybody out there, and he's just a great person. He's done so many things in his career, and that was good getting an insight on what he's all about and what he's doing. November 30th, we got Robert Livingston, who's the regional president and GM of Caesars Entertainment, and he also runs a couple of properties in Southern California that are part of the Harris Group too. And he's got some very interesting stories to tell. He's a good friend, and you're going to really be amazed at some of his roots. He grew up in Mississippi, and his dad was a car parts dealer, and he's got some interesting stories about those times. Anyways, thanks for listening. Appreciate it. And remember, everybody's got a story to tell. You just have to have time to listen. And join us on the next episode. Thanks. Have a good night, and happy Thanksgiving.